Blog Talk Radio.
This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine with Take Aim, a new show on Blog Talk Radio. We are with Accuracy in Media, and we are celebrating our 40th year in business as the original media watchdog group. Accuracy in Media was founded back in 1969 by Reed Irvine, who was an economist, speechwriter at the Federal Reserve, and he was quite concerned by what was going on in the media and how they were covering the war in Vietnam, and he decided that something needed to be done. And what happened is history, because when Reed passed away about 5 years ago, many people noted that what he had done with Accuracy in Media was a forerunner for much of the new media that exists today. We have done many different things. We attend annual shareholder meetings of New York Times, The Washington Post. We take out full-page ads. We are a daily grassroots organization that's constantly monitoring the media, making trying to correct their errors and to eliminate their bias, and to we also do a lot of investigative work ourselves to show what the media are ignoring and what and why they're leaving it out. Anyway, now we are trying to stay current with all the new media, and the new chairman for the last 5 years is Reed Irvine's son, Don Irvine, who is my co-host on this show, and Don has become one of the leaders in the new media arena, and he's often speaking about this. And Don, why don't you talk a little, introduce yourself, and then we'll bring on our guests. Today we have two guests, Frank Gaffney of the Center for Security Policy and Matthew Vadim. So both of these gentlemen will be on. We've got a lot of interesting topics we're going to be talking about. So, Don, take it away there.
All right. Well, thanks, Roger, for taking on the duties of co-hosting with me. Hope the audience will enjoy the program, as Roger has said as well. And with regard to AIM and new media, obviously this is an area that has exploded in interest over the last couple of years. And continues to pick up steam. Initially, you have the kind of the Facebook explosion of college students using Facebook to communicate with each other, and was limited to those only on college campuses. Then Facebook opened it up to others, allowing oldsters like me to go and join in the fray. And it has been an interesting experience to make connections that way, both business and personal that way. But obviously one of the biggest changes in this arena has been the advent of Twitter. Many of the listeners, I'm sure, know about Twitter. They probably use Twitter on a regular basis. But where Twitter is really picking up steam, it's gone from the occasional report going back to when a young man was thrown in a Saudi prison and had disappeared basically, but they had taken away his cell phone, and he tweeted out a message that he was in jail, and his friends all over the world got hold of that and managed to get him out, to something now where you've seen most recently in Iran, and you'll see other areas where just the number of people that are tweeting things has just grown exponentially. They call it a revolution. I think that is something that people can judge individually if that is really true as to whether or not it's a revolution per se, but it definitely is an amazing phenomenon. AIM has dived headlong into this, or as much as we can. We do have a Twitter account, and the followers are growing steadily on that, and we are trying to be very, very active in tweeting out interesting news items, particularly about what happens in the news media, but because of the nature of the things that we cover in D.C., it will wind up being a wide range of things along that line, too. Beyond using Facebook and Twitter, we are actively engaged with our interns this summer of creating videos, and one of our interns covered an AFL-CIO rally not too long ago on healthcare and got some pretty good footage of a couple of representatives, young girls from Acorn, trying to figure their way out about this, and it made for some very amusing video footage that has now for us surpassed the 12,000 mark and continues to grow every day. So we're very pleased with that, and the other videos are coming along. We're getting a lot of chances to interview politicians and kind of try to create another perspective of the news and get some of the news that you don't see in the mainstream press out to the masses. And people always are obviously free to use our material in any way, shape, or form that they can. So that's kind of covering most of that. Anything else? Did I miss something, Roger?
No, I think just that a lot of people are calling on you to come out and explain this and how the conservative movement can utilize it to catch up with what the left has been doing in this arena. And I think you've done a great job for us and for the movement in figuring this out and helping lead the way in this regard. So, you know, there's so much material out there that we follow and need to watch. Today we've got, you know, the healthcare reform issues, and the Sotomayor hearings are going on, and we have a active blog on our website, aim.org, that everybody, we encourage you to sign up for our daily emails, to read our blogs regularly. Watch for us later this year. We're going to be having our 40th anniversary, a big event in October, and that we're hoping that, as usual, C-SPAN will be there to cover it. So we've got a lot going on, and really looking forward to having our two guests on here today. So also just wanted to mention our editor, Cliff Kincaid, has been doing some great work on a number of issues going on, sovereignty issues, some of the treaties that the Obama administration is trying to push through now, which include, you know, the Law of the Sea Treaty and the International Criminal Court. And we have really been in the forefront of warning about the dangers of these treaties and seeing what can happen in terms of trying to stave them off. So there's plenty of material, plenty of things that we're watching. You know, let me just mention something else while we're waiting for our first caller, our first guest, rather, Frank Gaffney, to join us. And this week is kind of an anniversary week at AIM. A couple of big issues that we were very much in the forefront of a decade or so back. One of them is the downing of TWA 800, which happened on July 17th, 1996, and which we did a lot of freedom of information, dug out a lot of information, and did a documentary on that, and to get to the truth of what really brought that plane down and to expose the government cover-up. And another one that was a big deal for AIM for many years was the death of Vince Foster, the deputy White House counsel for Bill Clinton, who was found dead in Fort Marcy Park nearby Washington, D.C. back in 1993, and led to an amazing mystery and investigation that we were very much a part of, and it was very important to Don Stead Reed and to what we were doing here at Accuracy and Media, exposing both government and media lies and misinformation and cover-ups, and that's very much what we're about and what we try to do. So there've certainly been, I mean, we cover many topics, global warming, all sorts of things, and hopefully you will join us on this show and join us at our website, and that we will start something that will be going for a long time here. Follow us on Twitter. We really welcome this opportunity to start up this show and have you join us. So Let's see. Don, is anything else you want to add right now?
Well, you were mentioning anniversaries, Roger, and
uh-huh.
I think we, even though we haven't touched upon this for a number of years, this week, I believe it's actually Saturday, will mark the 40th anniversary of Chappaquiddick. And I frankly don't expect that the media will do much. I think there'll be some media sensitivity probably towards the, you know, Senator Kennedy and his current illness, but I think a large part of that will also be their inherent bias and that they won't want to dredge up that incident, which he's really never answered for. And I'm hoping that maybe we'll be able to do a little bit of something in the next week or so to kind of see how the media covered that and maybe do some analysis of that as well. It's an important incident that, you know, something that he got away with, clearly, in my mind.
Yes, and just this week, HBO, which is part of the Time Warner family, is running a documentary, a new one, basically about Ted Kennedy, and it's just completely laudatory. I didn't see the whole thing, so I'm really not sure if they touched on that subject, but I watched the last 20 minutes or so of it, and the tone of it was just completely laudatory and praising him, and you know, his links with, and his endorsement of Obama and all that, and just reminds, you know, HBO again, part of the Time Warner family, recently did one on Helen Thomas, who we have a piece up on our website right now about sort of the other side of Helen Thomas. But again, here's Time Warner. They also run the Bill Maher Show, which is a show that just completely blasting conservatives. And, you know, he's been a little harsh on Obama recently, but just for not being as far left as they would like him to be. But this is an area where entertainment and news sort of cross lines in ways that I think should make a lot of people feel uncomfortable about the news we get. In other words, is it ratings driven, and the bias that, you know, it's not very likely that they would have a show treating Reagan, for instance, in the way that they're treating Kennedy on something like this, or having someone on an HBO hour special who's going to be ripping into Nancy Pelosi and Obama. It's just not going to happen. So it's pervasive. It's not just the mainstream media where these issues reside and where this needs to be watched and monitored and brought forth to the public. Let's see. We're expecting Frank Gaffney, so bear with us, folks. This is our first time out on this, and there's a few technological issues that we're trying to get through, but just to give you a little preview, we're planning on talking to Mr. Gaffney, who, let me just take the couple minutes to introduce him now before we get him online, but he is the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan educational group founded in 1988. And Frank was nominated by President Reagan in 1987 to become the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, which was the senior position in the Defense Department with responsibility for policies involving nuclear forces, arms control, and U.S.-European defense relations. He, from 1983 to 87, he was, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Forces and Arms Control Policy. And he has a Master's of Arts degree in International Studies from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We just got notice he will be with us very shortly. He's running a few minutes late, but he should be here very soon. Frank has been a leading spokesman and a great source on many issues, missile defense, the relations with Russia and the former Soviet Union, with the issue of Sharia-compliant finance, which we will get into when he's on the phone with us. So he's got a lot of compelling insights that we know you will find very interesting. He recently has his own, started up his own radio show, and maybe he'll tell us a little about that as well. So but for instance, we were going to talk to him about the recent trip to Russia by President Obama, and did this serve American interests, or what was it really about, and what did Russia want out of this trip? And we're going to find that out. I think he's here with us right now. Let's see.
Hello, it's Frank Afton.
Frank?
Hi, I'm terribly sorry about being a little delayed. Thanks for bearing with me.
Not a problem. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine on with you.
Two of my favorite people. I'm great, thanks.
Thank you so much. Well, we've just introduced you. I went through your background and you know, mentioned your new radio show and your academic and Defense Department background and your Center for Security Policy. So
I'm sorry to have missed all that. Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
I hope you did go on.
You've had quite a career.
On and on.
Say.
Thank
well, Don,
you
want to start out here?
Sure, Frank. Good to talk with you again. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my privilege. Thank you.
Well, how did President Obama do on his first summit with Russia?
I think, as anticipated, he continued the practice that he's engaged in elsewhere around the world, which is essentially one of sort of taking a dive, if you will. He made much of an arms control agreement, or the outlines, really, of an arms control agreement that he has signed or has approved with the Russians, that I think will be not only a mistake in its own right, but as part of a larger approach to nuclear forces and deterrence, potentially a disaster for the United States. He engaged in negotiations on missile defense that signaled a willingness to cashier the defensive system that his predecessor had achieved unanimity behind in NATO, that would involve deployments in Poland and the Czech Republic, which will, I think, undermine friendly governments throughout Western Europe, certainly in those two countries. He signaled in his conversations, as best we can tell, the same kind of apologies for the United States, an understanding and even, it would appear, an acquiescence to the kind of Russian neo-imperialism that I think is you know, deeply worrying, certainly to Russia's neighbors, and it should be to us and to other freedom-loving people. So in those many respects, I'm afraid it was more of the same, and I think little good could come of it.
So were there any aspects at all that would have advanced American interests in any way?
Oh, look, I think that the president wants very much to be seen as a man who can get along with adversaries or potential adversaries, and in principle, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It really just depends on the terms under which it's done. And I think what we've seen again in Moscow and in Cairo and in his travels in South America is evidence that the president is really prepared to engage, notably with Iran, with the Iranian mullahs, even as they are engaged in this kind of brutal repression of their people. The Hugo Chavez's of Latin America, even as they're trying to undo a democratic restoration in Honduras. The Russians and Chinese, even as they're engaged in various efforts to consolidate their repressive rule at home and engage in, I think, increasingly aggressive behavior abroad. All of that is not the kind of thing you want the president to sort of ignore as he seeks to engage with such people.
So from what you've read and saw in the papers and mainstream media, how do you rate their coverage of the trip to Russia?
By and large, I think it's sort of more of the same as well. The media has given the president essentially a pass on any kind of critical coverage, arguably before he became president, but certainly since he was sworn in. And I think that by and large, it's hard to generalize because there's an awful lot of stuff written and broadcast, but I think by and large, the idea that the president is quite properly engaged in negotiations that smack of a time long past, namely, the U.S.-Soviet bipolar world, that is seen as perfectly legitimate, treated in a totally uncritical way, and I think it sort of goes on from there. To the extent that there are things that the president does that deserve acclamation, I think, for example, he did make some gestures in the direction of democratic opponents in Russia. He should be commended for that, but I think much of the rest of it really deserves a more objective criticism from the press and, for that matter, from the rest of us than it's gotten to date.
Let me step in here. First, let me mention that we also, if anyone wants to call in and have a question for Frank, they can call at 347-426-3984. That's 347-426-3984. Frank, so one of the issues, of course, was this missile reduction, arms reduction, and I don't know if you feel this makes us any safer, and how does this tie into the issue of missile defense that seems to be so important to the Russians in terms of what we were wanting to build and put online there in Poland and all that. So tell us about that aspect of this.
Sure. Roger, this gets pretty arcane, so let me just try to treat it at a fairly elementary level, because I think effectively that's all you really need,
right,
to know. Your common sense will kick in. The Russians, we're told, are obliged by dint of their difficult economic circumstances to reduce their nuclear arsenal. Yet they're modernizing it intensively, something we're not doing. They want to bring the numbers of weapons and launchers, as they say, to a much lower level to suit them. They may or may not honor those levels, as they frequently have cheated in the past, but they know we will. And if they can get a president of the United States to join them in making reductions they have to make anyway, we're told, that's a strategic plus for them. If they can, in addition, parlay this into new restrictions on missile defense, something that since President Bush wisely removed us from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty that prohibited us effectively from having a missile defense, that would be a further net plus to the Russians from a strategic point of view. They're not going to allow their missile defenses to be restricted, you can be sure. So in all of these ways, it seems to me just the deal that was announced and the deal sort of on missile defense that seems to be in the works are bad from an American strategic interest point of view. But worse than that is the fact that unknown to the vast majority of Americans is the president's commitment, stated most recently in the Czech Republic and in Moscow, to a global world without nuclear weapons. that is to say a nuclear-free world, as he puts it, is being advanced not so much by this deal with the Russians as by his continued pursuit of denuclearization of the United States. And again, this gets pretty arcane, but this is the short form of it. If you don't have programs for modernizing our forces, our nuclear forces, for maintaining effectively the ones we have, and for testing them to make sure that they're effective and credible, what you're effectively doing is setting us up for disarmament unilaterally. And that's what worries me most about the Obama agenda, is he's not going to disarm the rest of the world. I don't know of a single nuclear power on the planet that is going to join him in getting rid of their nuclear arms. But he can disarm us. And again, I think that's a very dangerous thing in a world like this.
Well, the issue has been framed as us doing the missile defense really to protect against missiles from Iran coming into Europe or other parts of to Israel or other parts of the Middle East or in Eastern Europe, but the Russians seem to take it as it was aimed at them as sort of a Cold War relic. And so is it really missile defense that we might put in Europe helpful against to deter the Iranians from doing what everyone is assuming that they are doing, which is building nuclear weapons?
Well, I don't think our missile defenses, if we can get them deployed in Europe, will deter them from pursuing nuclear weapons. It may, if we're lucky, prevent them from using them against us or against our allies. But at the moment, it appears the Obama administration is quite prepared to cashier those defenses in Europe. And if that's the case, not only will we not be deterring the Iranian nuclear program, we won't be able to defend ourselves against what comes out of it. And that is tremendously worrying when you know, as we do, that Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, now reelected, is made no secret of his desire to wipe Israel off the map and to bring about a world without America. It's in short, I think it's, I call it national security policy malpractice to engage in missile defense reductions or constraints, or let alone elimination, in this kind of environment.
Okay.
I have to go, guys. I thought you were done at 11:30.
Okay.
I apologize, but I've been keeping some people waiting, and I thank you so much for allowing me to join you.
Well, thank you very much.
Hope we
have
can do
other
it again.
Things we'd like to talk to you about, and maybe another show soon. Okay?
Love to. Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Bye-bye.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah. So we're now going to work on getting our other guest. We had pushed him back a few minutes, but we'll see if we can get him on the phone here shortly. And Don, there were some very interesting things that Frank had to say, and very troubling. Anything in particular you took away from that?
Well, I think Frank is just a wonderful expert on these issues. It's just a vast wealth of knowledge on these things. I think on Russia, I mean, our missile defense. I mean, this is a very big deal. And I don't really think that the majority of the American public understands, what was really going on over there, that there was a lot of glad-handing. But, Putin is definitely making a play here, and he's putting his thumb down, and he's not NATO-friendly. And so we've got a lot of issues to, there's been a big sea change with Obama in office. And I think I'm as worried as Frank is about what the future holds with Obama in there and dealing with Putin and his cohorts.
Yes, other couple things that I had hoped to get in with him, but our time was cut short. But he's been written a lot about and talk a lot about the influence of Saudi money and these madrasas and things that are and schools that they have going on in Virginia. He's also been an advocate for reducing our dependence on Middle East oil, but not because of global or supposed global warming, but because it finances a lot of terrorist activity. So there's a lot of topics that would be great to talk to him about, and hopefully we'll get another chance. But in the meantime, let me introduce who I know is going to be calling in very shortly, Matthew Vadim, who is a senior editor with the Capital Research Center, formerly a CRC, Capital Research Center Fellow, and a veteran journalist. He has written and for the Wall Street, for a number of papers, I think the Wall Street Journal, the American Spectator. I saw him recently on the Fox News Channel on Glenn Beck's show. And he has done a lot of coverage of both the nomination of potential Supreme Court Justice, say likely Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, but he's also done a lot to expose the group ACORN. And we hope to get his comments on those two subjects, and I think you will find this quite fascinating.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Matthew Vadim here.
Hi, Matthew. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine, and we welcome you to take AIM, our new radio, our internet blog show, and we're
great.
Happy to have you on here. I just was introducing you and telling you about your background with Capital Research Center.
Okay,
and,
great.
Yeah, and we saw you recently on Glenn Beck's show. So,
right.
Couple
taking
things.
Shots at ACORN.
At ACORN, yeah. Well, we want to follow up on that and get into that a little bit. Don, you want to start out here?
Sure. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there.
Obviously, we're going through the Sonia Sotomayor hearings at this point. What, if anything, has surprised you about these hearings on her nomination?
Well, I'm surprised that Lindsey Graham has been so aggressive so far. That he's actually been asking her tough questions. But I still don't think that that Republicans have challenged this reigning orthodoxy that you can't be a racist if you are a member of a minority group. And this is a double standard that has been around for decades, and Republicans haven't countered it. And the argument that I was making on the American Spectator article on the 14th, trumping the race card at spectator.org, was that by failing to challenge this false notion, they are perpetuating it. And until they actually start taking it on and calling it the BS that it really is, then it's going to be difficult for them to make any progress when it comes to issues related to race.
What about her record, in terms of her opinions being rejected by higher courts?
Yeah, she's had a lot of opinions rejected by higher courts, and I'm no lawyer, but from my reading of it, she's not particularly thoughtful. She is not particularly brilliant, or well spoken. And if you've been watching her during the confirmation hearings, I haven't watched all of it because it's because I have a life and a job, but she just keeps contradicting herself and spinning her previous comments. And I just don't believe her when she talks, when she tries to spin away her infamous wise Latina comment. I don't think that it was just she said the other day it was an attempt to inspire people. But if you read it and if you look at the full context of it, it certainly doesn't seem like that. It seems like she is just expressing this bigoted opinion that she's better than other people because she is a wise Latina, because she's a wise Latina woman. And if the shoe were on the other foot, if it were a white man saying that, then I think pretty well everyone in American society would agree that that was racist. But because it's not, people have this conceptual difficulty because they've been brainwashed over the decades, and they don't seem to be able to accept it as the racist comment that it is. She's not very straightforward, and it seems that she's suiting her answers. She's being like a politician, and is being very unjudge-like. When you watched now Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito during their confirmation hearings, they actually seem to have a clear judicial philosophy. But with Judge Sonia Sotomayor, it's not really clear that she believes in anything in particular. Her views are so mutable, so malleable, that she's willing to jettison them in order to not look bad in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This raises issues about her character. Is she a truthful, honest person? Does she have integrity? And right now, I'd say it's not looking very good. If Republicans continue to pound away at her, maybe they can make some headway. Maybe she could actually be defeated, though it seems that they don't have the stomach to do that right now. You can, even if you've got a supermajority against you, you can make progress. You can still win by using appropriate tactics. And I'm still not convinced that they're willing to do that.
Well, she seems to be getting away with this, as you point out, that the Republicans, while they may be making some fairly strong statements, no one seems to think that there's nearly enough votes or support to keep her off the Supreme Court. And you pointed to the wise Latina woman comment and how she seems to really be taking a totally different position now. And what are some of the other things? I know today some of the firefighters from the Ritchie case are supposed to be addressing the committee. I haven't seen much of today either, what's going on. So, but that case and gun control, what are a couple other things that where her past record and comments don't seem to jibe with what she's now telling the committee? Are you aware of others?
Well, I'm not sure that I can think of anything right at the moment.
Okay.
But there, I just wanted let me add something to what I was saying a minute ago, and then we can return to this.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that the committee chairman, Pat Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, laid down a marker in his opening statement, and he implied that if you criticize Sotomayor's comment, the wise Latina woman comment, that in itself was racist, and that he brought up examples of strange questions being asked of other Supreme Court nominees, such as Louis Brandeis was asked weird questions about the Jewish mind and how its operations are complicated by altruism, and Thurgood Marshall was asked if he was prejudiced against Southern white people. These strike me as odd questions, and it's an apple and oranges type comparison. He cautioned the Republican members of the panel against doing that sort of thing, but none of the Republican members of the panel are interested in doing such a thing. They don't want to. They're not accusing her. They're not doing the same things that their predecessors did many years ago. What I am going to be interested in is seeing how the firefighters take on, how Mr. Ricci and the rest of them take on the issue. I think you may see some real sparks from if the liberal Democrats on the committee start trying to depict the firefighters as, you know, as this elite, as this privileged, this group of privileged white males. Because as we all know, firefighters are working class people. They're public servants. And it's a tactic that I expect would backfire, would blow up in their faces. So I hope they do it. I hope they go after the firefighters and try to paint them as you know, as stodgy, out of touch white males, because I think that would definitely cause a strong backlash against them. And because they're liberals, they can't really help themselves. You know, this is what they actually believe in. Did you watch the other day in the opening statements when Dianne Feinstein was practically drooling over Sonia Sotomayor, saying, oh, you're such a special person and you've overcome so much? Well, you know, she sounds like she had a rough childhood, but many people have had rough childhoods. What about Clarence Thomas, who struggled against, a great deal, many more obstacles when he was growing up, and who lived basically in a hut, you know, when he was a little kid? This is, you can't really compare the two experiences. And really, Sonia Sotomayor hasn't had it that rough. Another thing is that she's also trying to pander to the left by appearing to be an affirmative action baby, but really, she has, it certainly seems like she has succeeded, she succeeded academically through her own hard work, and yet she's trying to say that it has something to do with affirmative action, and it's just another example of her pandering. If she's pandering like this, if she's being like a politician in a black robe right now, just wait till she gets onto the actual Supreme Court.
So you think this is a fight that the Republicans should be making, even though they can clearly see the handwriting on the wall that there's 60 Democrats, and so far haven't seen anything to indicate that any of them will be voting against her? But do you think as a matter of principle and politics?
Yes. Uh-huh. And they also seem to have been cowed into submission by this leftist, this Democratic narrative that if you go rough on a Latino nominee, that you're, you know, all Latino voters are going to hate you for the rest of time. And I just don't think that's true. You know, as long as it doesn't look like they're ganging up on her because of her race or because of her sex, I think they're going to be fine as long as they stick to the issues. And I think they're going to be fine. Another thing that's disturbing, you asked for an example of, and I don't remember what she said during the hearing regarding this, but she also took an odd position on gun control. She ruled in that Second Circuit case, she ruled with the majority there to that there was no individual right to keep and bear arms as applied against the states. And this ruling would seem to contradict the Supreme Court's ruling last year in District of Columbia versus Heller, the case that struck down the draconian handgun prohibitions in the nation's capital. And her views are quite troublesome and worrying, especially when you consider that the Heller case was decided 5-4. You know, basically 5 members of the court voted that the Second Amendment actually means what it says, and 4 said, no, it doesn't. It doesn't count. Let's pretend it's not even part of the Bill of Rights. So, you know, this too is worrying.
Well, let me step back in here for a second. How would you rate the media coverage of the hearings at this point?
Well, I think the Post at least said that Sotomayor was under fire yesterday. But, you know, they seem to be accentuating the positive so far. At least TV does. not Fox, perhaps, but CNN and the rest of the network news seem to be, sympathetic in their coverage. of the sodomy of sodomy or so far, and they don't seem too keen on pointing out her inconsistencies and some of her, you know, some of her controversial ideas that I suspect the overwhelming majority of the American people, you know, would reject, especially with respect to gun control, since gun control is not a political winner, and the people of the United States overwhelmingly support the right to keep and bear arms, and they accept it as an individual right, not a so-called collective right, as many liberals and Democrats say it is.
So, Matthew, would you care to make a prediction what the final vote in the Senate is going to be for confirmation?
Right now, it looks like it'll be pretty well along party lines.
So you think it's going to be 60-something to 30?
Well,
huh?
Byrd and Kennedy are often out sick
right
nowadays, fighting with their own medical problems. So I think it may be, senators are so hard to coalesce, to herd into a group. So, you know, I would guess it'd be something like 58-38. That would be my guess right now, unless something breaks. I suspect the Democrats will be completely united. Maybe that Ben Nelson guy will break off from Nebraska. Mm-hmm. So maybe that would maybe be more like 57-38, a couple of Republicans not voting.
Yes. Well, I would be surprised, really, if not. I would expect more Republicans to end up voting to confirm her, but we'll see what happens. But let's use the rest of our time to talk about ACORN. First,
okay.
Just give us a little background. Who are they, and why should we care?
Okay, ACORN is the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. It was founded in 1970 by, well, at least the primary founder, the main founder, was Wade Rathke. It grew out of the radical cluster of groups in the late 1960s, the Students for a Democratic Society, disintegrated and split up into various, many different little factions. One of them was the Weather Underground, and its leaders, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn and the rest of them, decided that the best way to change society was to take on the system and blow things up and kill people. So that's what they did or tried to do. And then another splinter group believed that the best way to change society was to fight the system from within and to be nonviolent. And that was, ACORN grew out of that. ACORN, Wade Rathke, the founder of ACORN, was a draft resistance order for students, organizer for Students for a Democratic Society, and he was also an organizer for a radical group headed by an activist in the 60s named George Wiley. It was called the National Welfare Rights Organization, and the National Welfare Rights Organization was created as part of the welfare rights movement, and they believed that everyone who is legally entitled to welfare should claim every dollar, and this was part of an effort to overwhelm the welfare rolls in order to bankrupt the government and force radical social change. The strategy was articulated by the two university professors who founded the National Welfare Rights Organization, Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. They came up with the Cloward-Piven strategy. There's a good page on it at discoverthenetworks.org that explains how it worked. So ACORN, you know, Wade Rathke was not only a disciple of Saul Alinsky, but a believer, a supporter of the ideas of Cloward and Piven, and he created ACORN to get people onto welfare. So it's not, if it helps people, great. But that's secondary. The main purpose is to overwhelm the government. And ACORN has been very good at this over the years. They have tried to overwhelm the system a number of different ways. Through the earned income tax credit, which, as you know, is is arguably a form of welfare. It's a government tax credit. It's money from the government that you can claim if your income doesn't meet a certain level. So it's kind of a negative income tax. And they set up earned income tax credit centers, financial justice centers, and a number of other things. They're kind of H&R Block for subversives, you could say, encouraging people to claim as much money as they can from the government, poor people. They also strongly pushed the Community Reinvestment Act, which is a kind of financial affirmative action law that forces banks to lend money to people who won't be able to pay the money back in an effort to bring fairness and equity to lending. And the Community Reinvestment Act allowed groups like Acorn to lobby during the Community Reinvestment Act report card stage, where a bank examiner would go in and do a study on a bank and decide if they're if they're satisfying the goals of the Community Reinvestment Act. Then Acorn could go in and start to cause trouble and say, we're not going to support this merger of your bank with another bank if you don't start lending money to the groups that we serve. And so they would pressure the banks and pressure the bank examiners to give a failing grade on the CRA report cards and cause trouble in that way. They went so far.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to try to get into the voter registration, because that's where they were in the news quite a bit last year during the election.
Sure.
For the voter fraud. I mean, and they've been some of their people indicted. And tell us about that. And have they been indicted as a group, or is it just certain individuals?
Well, they used to brag about how they've never been indicted for any kind of election fraud, and I think that was true up until a few weeks ago, when the state of Nevada actually indicted Acorn for voter registration fraud. The Democratic Attorney General and the Democratic Secretary of State in Nevada laid these charges after investigating Acorn in Las Vegas for some time. They even claimed that they seized a training manual from the Nevada Acorn office, spelling out how to use quota systems on employees when registering voters. And this is illegal in Nevada because the reasoning goes it incentivizes fraud and false voter registrations. So they caught Acorn apparently red-handed. So they charged the entity itself, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, and they charged two senior executives, whose names I can't recall right now, who were running their voter registration outfit in Las Vegas, and those charges are pending. There are also charges pending right now, not against Acorn per se, but in Cleveland, in Cuyahoga County, Ohio. A local grand jury indicted a voter named Darnell Nash in the Shaker Heights neighborhood of Cleveland, who had been registered repeatedly to vote by Acorn workers.
So now we hear that they could get up to $8 billion out of this stimulus package.
They could be, but let me just explain what that actually means. They could get out of the stimulus package and the fiscal 2010 HUD budget. The government's fiscal year starts October 1st. They could get $8.5 billion. Now, that doesn't mean they will get $8.5 billion. They certainly won't. They won't even get a billion. But they're going to get something out of it. And the point is, should such a shady organization that's so corrupt be getting any government funds? And I studied the HUD budget for fiscal 2010 and the stimulus package that was signed into law by the president in February, and that's how I came up with the $8.5 billion figure. It's actually, I think, $3 billion in the stimulus, $5.5 billion in the HUD budget, including CDBG or Community Development Block Grant monies. So
okay,
ACORN is eligible to get this money.
Don, go ahead. We're running low on time, but we want to get a couple more questions in here.
All right. Well, we've been talking about the voter registration thing. That really leads into, what about the census? There's been a lot of reports about their involvement in the census. What is ACORN going to be doing with regard to that?
It is not entirely clear, but it is clear that the Obama Census Department, the Obama Census Bureau, which is part of the Commerce Department, has been lying about ACORN's involvement. The census official said ACORN has nothing to do with us, you know, running the census and coordinating it. Judicial Watch did an excellent FOIA, or Freedom of Information Act, request a few weeks ago and got 100-and-something pages of documents from the Census Bureau in which they made it clear that ACORN was allowed to sign up late for the to be a participant in the census. They signed up in February, when the deadline was January. February, you know, when Obama had been in power for a few weeks already. And ACORN Census Bureau reached out to ACORN asking it to advise it on hiring decisions in the field. So ACORN, with its history of voter registration fraud and corruption and embezzlement and graft and corruption and so on, is being asked to help choose who is going to be running the census in America. And this can't be a good thing.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time, but would you say that ACORN is playing a significant role in corrupting the electoral process for, you know, next year's elections and future elections, and then with their ties
sure.
to Obama?
Sure, it is, and it does have ties to Obama. I'm not. For the more I study ACORN, though, I'm not convinced that ACORN actually thinks it can throw an election, that it can influence an election through, you know, putting Mickey Mouse on the ballot, on the voter rolls and so on. It's just that ACORN likes to cause chaos, and ACORN is defrauding its funders, various foundations like George Soros' Open Society Institute and so on, give ACORN money to register poor people. ACORN just wants the money, so they tell their volunteers to tell their canvassers to make up names, and they've been getting away with it for a long time. And they like causing chaos and crisis because they thrive in that environment. Radical leftists love it.
We're going to have to end it there, but we thank you so much for being on our premier show. And
thanks very much.
We're going to have to sign off. Don,
okay.
It's been a pleasure. And Matthew, thank you all very much.
CapitalResearch.org is our website at Capital Research Center.
CapitalResearch.org. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
See you next week, or hear you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.